Okay, Brian. Anyone got any? Let's have some questions first of all. Anyone wants got any questions for Rob? The usual wait while somebody packs on courage to break the first silence.
Quaker silent meeting.
Go on, Dan.
Well, if you want the silence broken, I've got a couple of my own experience. I've been married for very nearly 38 years to a journalist. Well, an ex-journalist now, she's retired. And she worked for a broadsheet. And most of the journalists that she worked with were, in a sense, left-wing. And, I mean, it was the Daily Telegraph. And she would say that most of the journalists on the Daily Telegraph thought that what they actually published was bollocks. You know, it was awful. But it was a way of getting a living. That was it. You know, it got a wage packet in the pocket. And I ventured on a few occasions to send her a work with Socialist Dan, which she could, show to various colleagues. To get her opinion on it, and always like the critique come back that it was the Dutch is there, obviously it's the pub for our own publication. It conformed to the ABC the ABC laws of journalism. It was accurate, brief, and
concise, and clear.
And I thought it was extremely well written. So therefore you've got educated people who are used to words and used to communicating, but they're just communicating a message that is laid down by the proprietor, that anything that strays beyond those boundaries is inadmissible in that newspaper. So therefore, it bears out Rob's point that what you get, I mean, it's the ideas of the society are are always the ideas of those who rule. Or you could say the golden rule. Those with all the gold make all the rules, and they're enforced through corporate commercial media.
Okay. Anyone else?
Can I show it? Can I come back on?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, okay. Don't worry. Yeah, I mean, I guess I should have sort of finished the whole thing, by quoting Marx and Engels and say, the rules of the ideas of the ruling class are always, the ideas of the society, the dominant. I've forgotten that. That's why I didn't, because I've forgotten the quote. I'm sure one of you smarty pantsers out there will remind me of it. The dominant ideas of society are ever those of the ruling class. Thank you, Brian. Just about kind of quotes back in. I'd be a little bit cautious within that, though, Danny. I didn't kind of articulate this very well within the speech, but I wouldn't necessarily portray the Daily Telegraph in particular as a bunch of basically bored, cynical centre leftists. Yeah, maybe about 20 years ago, but I think a lot of them actually will be kind of ideologically committed conservatives, of one sort of stripe or another. Now, how do you get to be a journalist on a national newspaper? You have to have gone through a certain kind of education, usually a PPE degree, politics, philosophy and education degree, usually at Oxbridge. You will probably come from that background. Therefore, you probably will share the norms and assumptions of the ruling class. This is why it's so efficient. This is why it works. Because these people don't question the underlying nature of capitalism and the nature of our society that we live in. They may want to tinker about on the edges, and they may not like a particular sort of person or whatever, but they don't ask these kind of fundamental questions. And more to the point, you probably won't get into that position where you'll be offered that job if you express these opinions. You're not going to be kind of recruited. I couldn't stomach working for something like the Daily Telegraph. I mean, I've got to be honest. I don't want to make it a big, kind of moral thing or whatever. There's no way I'd work for these kind of scumbags. Pardon the kind of crude phraseology. These people are our enemies. The Conrad Blacks and the Rupert Murdochs of this world are our class enemies. They are not people whose ideas we should be propagating. I'd much rather do what I do, work in a supermarket and do my political, and trade union work and activity that way. All right, you know, it's how you look at yourself in the mirror in the morning. You know, I also, lastly, I'd like to say, you know, human beings have a great capacity for self-deception. You know, I'm sure eventually you end up internalising these values, even if to begin with you may be a bit anti for sort of some of them. Because, you know, in the end of the day, yeah, you're right, it's what's putting, you know, food on your table, paying your mortgage or whatever. So you just slip into it and go with it.
Well, if
you can give me a quick...
Yeah, very quickly. I mean, what I was talking about, I should have included it, was that she was a sub-editor.
Mm.
And she worked with sub-editors. Now, most sub-editors the sub-editors she worked for at the time were like her. Left school early and got themselves jobs on either magazines or in provincial newspapers. And then, you know, they didn't become actual accredited writers, but they were sub-editors.
Mm.
And so therefore, you know, they had more of a working class outlook on life.
Jacqueline?
I found the talk very interesting, but I did expect an interesting talk from the South London branch.
You know me.
Thank you very much. But I'm also interested in this newspaper thing.
Yep.
One, Daily Telegraph. I mean, I last heard about the capitalist media around 1992, when the Polytechnic of North London was still going.
Yeah.
That's where I heard about all that. And five people controlled every single newspaper. It was about a handful. They even named them, listed them, gave us all the graphs and everything. And that's the only... I haven't heard anything about it since, apart from this talk. It's at the back of my mind, vaguely. But I take exception to what you've just said about the Daily Telegraph. I know it's not a... socialist newspaper now, I know that now, but then neither are any other of the newspapers out there. But I enjoy art, I enjoy culture, I like reading about people who are in the arts and stuff, and I have to say for the Daily Telegraph, they do some bloody good pages on that. That's why I read that newspaper. I don't read The Sun. In the 70s I used to tell people, don't read that paper, it's racist. They wanted to attack me on the top of the bus. I don't bother with all that sort of stuff now. I think people nowadays are a lot more savvy rather than intelligent. You know, we know we're getting nonsense. I've heard Pat Deutz once standing up there saying how when they do the news, they show you a picture of someone talking and a bus going past. Every time they talk about travel now, that's exactly... I start laughing, and I think about... I'm sitting indoors and laughing at the 6 o'clock news, because that's exactly what you see. The bus, the red bus going past. But we have I think we have a really good newspaper industry. I know this isn't what I should maybe be saying, but I love newspapers. I'm upset because there's no newspaper out there. I want to call my own daily paper. I really resent it because it's such rubbish that they're putting out there, the propaganda and everything else. The news is a complete waste of time. Even the Russian news now, RT on Channel 85, if you've got Freeview or whatever, where they're all in American accents telling you about Russia. I mean, it's hard to really comprehend what's going on. But the internet has also caused newspaper sales to fall and everything else. But hard copy media or newspapers and stuff like that, magazines, they're really catering, as you, I think, you did mention in your talk, to the advertisers. They're not interested in us, the general population. It's the advertisers who keep those papers going. The same way it is on the internet. It might be cheaper on the internet, but it's them who do it. And those are the ones they advertise to. I don't know if that's...
No, that's cool. That's very helpful. I mean, I don't want people to go away thinking, you know, there's nothing that's true, say, in the Daily Telegraph. I mean, I read the Daily Telegraph, not that regularly, but I do read it. And again, I mean, I read it for the sports coverage, actually. Absolutely brilliant, comprehensive sports coverage from all over the world. So, you know, I'm not necessarily, making pejorative remarks on the professionalism of, you know, the journalists who produce these, you know, articles. And yeah, you're right, again, you know, very, very good, you know, arts and culture kind of coverage in the Telegraph. I mean, what I do and what I advocate people to do, It is not necessarily look at what we traditionally perceive of as the right-wing press. You know, you use this critique, use these ideas towards like The Guardian, all right, or the BBC, the so-called left-leaning parts, all right, and then you'll really see how limited and pro-capitalist and awful that their attitudes are. You know, I mean, absolutely. You know, in one sense, you know the Sun's going to be rubbish. You know it's just going to be tits and bingo and football and, you know, celebrity news. You know, who cares? Yeah, exactly. You know, but you know, approach it in that way. You know, look at foreign news coverage in The Guardian, you will get interesting stuff, but you will also get the same old assumptions being trotted out. And of course, you know, I mean, I don't want to bang my drum about this. I guess I do have a bit of a chip on my shoulder about these sorts of things. But look who works for The Guardian. You know, look at their backgrounds. Look where they've been educated. You know, it's the same kind of people. It's the same kind of people all across the top of the media. You know, they get there by jumping through certain hoops, believing in certain things. That's how they get their jobs. They just have a slightly more, a slightly sort of different slant on how we should be controlled and capitalism should be run. So, yeah.
Okay. Any more comments?
Yes. I'd like Rob, if you can, to expand a little more on this idea of agenda setting.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, that he's right. There is an agenda which excludes certain strands of opinion, and I mean that's obvious. You only have to pick up a range of newspapers for a week, and there's clearly, you know, certain things are not discussed. Certain points of view don't appear. Now, it's obvious that say a newspaper office will have a daily editorial meeting with the editor, and you know, the half a dozen others decide what's going to go in tomorrow's newspaper. Now, that's fairly easy to see the point of that and say, well, this is where some of the agenda is agreed on or backed up. No, but it's a little more difficult to understand where the agenda is set in the wider society. I mean, it is generally an agenda virtually everywhere you go. Now, you know, I'm assuming there aren't half a dozen people in a smoke-filled room that we don't know about that set the agenda for us. But nevertheless, there is an agenda. Now, where does it come from?
Okay, all right. First of all, you know, going, you are absolutely right. There is no smoke-filled room with six people, you know, sitting around going, what are we going to tell the pros to think today? You know, that's not the way it works. I mean, I'll take you back to, you know, the filters that news go through. You know, it comes within the context of a capitalist society. You know, I mean, like I was saying to Jacqueline's point there, you know, these people come from certain kind of backgrounds. You know, they're going to think certain things. You know, you're not going to get a job in the media if you don't. And what I was also, it filters into what I was saying about concision as well. There is only so much you can say, you know. Also, of course, you know, there's pressure. You know, like I say, you know, a lot of it isn't some sinister ideological reason. You know, the reason there are certain things on the news is because, you know, that's what they're going to go with. They're under huge amounts of sort of time pressure. And, you know, like I was saying, you know, where do they get their information from? You know, they'll go to their cosy little kind of contact press officer. You know, they'll just get on the phone to the Prime Minister's spokesman, you know, rather than bothering to, or you know, because they don't have the time to go and do a wider sort of investigation. You know, so couldn't be bothered, you know, not necessarily calling into question their journalistic integrity or whatever, you know. That's the way it works. It's a very kind of soft sort of power structure, if you like, you know. And, you know, I mean, like I say, you know, if you're doing a 500 to 1,000 word piece on the euro, you know, you're not going to get a piece from somebody who's kind of doing a deep kind of investigation to the structures of, you know, how capitalism's developed in Europe in the last sort of 20 years or whatever. You know, they're just going to say so-and-so did this, so-and-so did that, you know, these are the solutions that the various people in governments are sort of talking about. You know, and again, you know, you don't get to be in government without thinking along a very narrow sort of set of lines. You know, you used to get a wee bit of variation in the old Labour Party, but certainly not now in New Labour. You know, they're completely managed. What they wear, what they say, where they come from. You know, they'll use things like selection quotas to get rid of people they don't like, you know. So you know, yeah. You know, they'd much rather have somebody, you know, who's on message, as the phrase goes, you know, who just happens to say be a woman, because it'll, you know, back up the quota that they have to have so many women kind of candidates. And they'll use that to, you know, squeeze out people who are kind of ideologically unacceptable. You know, look at the way that awful empty-headed idiot Tristram Hunt got to be an MP in Stoke. He's the MP for Stoke. He's the MP in Stoke-on-Trent. I mean, he was parachuted in because he's a media sort of celebrity and a completely kind of vapid, you know, centre-right New Labourist. And replaced, you know, a local, quite left-leaning sort of trade unionist who was going to be the MP in Stoke, who incidentally, you know, I mean, I know they're all reformists and everything, but this particular guy had been doing an awful lot of very good work. For example, you know, combating the BNP presence in Stoke-on-Trent, and, you know, was basically a Benite leftist. You know, well, he got the heave-ho, you know, completely in contradiction of any kind of supposed democratic structures within the local constituency Labour Party, for Tristram Hunt, who, you know, as you might know, is a kind of celebrity, vapid celebrity historian talking head, you know, who wrote a completely vapid, useless biography of Engels the other day. But anyway, you know, spit venom at them. But, you know, but I think, to, you know, to get back to you, Gwyn, that's very much the way it works. You know, it's... Orwell wrote a really, really illuminating essay in, I think, the late 30s, early 40s on this. He said a lot of journalists won't report facts that will not do, in his phrase. And, you know, I mean, he should know, you know, he was worked for, like, the New Statesman and other newspapers, you know, and was constantly frustrated by this process. You know, there were certain things that weren't, you didn't say in polite society, certainly not in your newspaper. Like, for example, one of the things Orwell advocated was independence for India. Completely right out. You know, you don't talk about that. That's you know, back in the late 30s, that was just not on the agenda. It was kind of, you know, it was crazy kind of leftists and lunatics who talked about that sort of thing. It wasn't done in the mainstream polite kind of commentary. I think, incidentally, that's a great kind of... And, you know, that was Orwell at his most sophisticated when he was talking about propaganda. You know, I know we probably all are familiar with 1984 and things like that, which, you know, it's fictional and it has some interesting kind of concepts in the way that power, you know, is done. But it's very much, that's a caricature of, you know, the kind of totalitarian way of doing it rather than how it kind of operates in a liberal democracy. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, you started off by saying it was counterintuitive that... you use the word efficient propaganda. How do you say effective propaganda? That in this country report, let's say the West Berlin, the USSR, or Nazi Germany, I think that that's a product of the propaganda system, having an efficient propaganda system. That the most important criterion for a good propaganda system is that people don't realise it's there. And this is what's happened. As soon as people start absorbing the propaganda and considering it normal, natural, they will cease questioning it. Okay? And there is a quotation, I don't know where it comes from, I wish I knew, that people in the Soviet Union, they were lucky. They knew that what they were being given was propaganda. Whereas here in the West, not only do the people not know that they're being given propaganda, but they don't know that they don't know. In other words, people are not aware that it's propaganda, but they don't even realise it's a propaganda system there in the first place. So I agree with you that the propaganda has been highly effective. And in fact, people like, you mentioned Walter Lippmann, but Bernays as well, they were saying that propaganda is the essence of democracy. The only way to lead a democracy is to propagandise the people so effectively that they basically conform. I could go on there, but I won't. But also, as regards advertising, when I was young, when most of us were young, there were papers around, like the News Chronicle,
the Daily Herald and the Reynolds News, these closed because of lack of advertising. Some people will maintain that there was a deliberate policy not to advertise in those papers because then they would go bankrupt. And other people say that maybe the advertisers couldn't make so much profit on elite products by advertising in these more working class papers, therefore they wouldn't advertise there. But certainly when the News Chronicle closed, it had a higher circulation than the Manchester Guardian, the Times and the Telegraph all combined. So that's another way that advertising works. It actually effectively closes down moderate left-wing opinion in the case of these in the case of these newspapers.
This comment, I don't know if it's very relevant to this discussion, but I used to work for the Telegraph as well, and in fact worked for the Chronicle in the advertisement departments. And I must say there was no hostility to my politics at all. Everyone knew what they were. And we didn't really discuss politics very much in the office, but everyone knew what mine were, and I didn't find any hostility. We used to discuss things and so on. So I thought I'd better know. I don't think the people that worked in the advertising department probably were the same as those who worked for the editorial. We didn't have a lot to do with them, but they didn't come from it. They all came from the working class of the backgrounds. It's different.
Sure, I mean, I'll take that on board, Marie, definitely. But firstly, I'd like to thank the last speaker. A couple of very good, absent points there. But specifically, Marie, I mean, that may be the case, Marie. I don't know what your sort of work circumstances were like. Maybe you were sort of the local eccentric in the paper. Do you know what I mean? It's just, it's Marie from advertising. She's a socialist, more seriously, I did study this. Now look at the way the Daily Telegraph covered the Kenyan emergency during that time. All right, disgustingly racist. I mean, just awful. Just the worst kind of, old stuff being dragged up from the 19th century. The phrase going there was that the Mau Mau are worse than the communists, because they were black. They were portrayed as utter savages. And to be fair, the Mau Mau did do some pretty terrible things. But then again, what do you expect when you've been brutalised for so long? One of the big things that they used to say in the Daily Telegraph is, the Mau Mau, they're so barbaric, they cut up British soldiers with machetes. It would be nice if they had Kalashnikovs, but that's all they've got, it was just absolutely, it was like something from the Zulu War. It was like something from the late Victorian age. And that is always, that point of view has always been transmitted through the Daily Telegraph. The Daily Telegraph is more or less the unofficial mouthpiece for a lot of the top military and ex-military in this country. That's who they go to. Their defence correspondent, an editor for years and years and years, was the right-wing commentator and military historian John Keegan, who was also, and at various times, a lecturer in Sandhurst Military College. All right, so there's a guy who is one of the experts that our wonderful officer class go to be trained in how to oppress and kill people. That's how objective they were. That's where it's kind of coming from. So I'd always be a bit kind of wary about people's kind of stories of working for it at a certain level. But you mustn't lose focus from what they were actually kind of doing. Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the people involved, unfortunately, but there was a programme on not so long ago where journalists were confessing how they had dealt with, and I think it was the Iraq War. I can't remember their names, but how they had reported it and what they had said, and they were very much regretting how they dealt with. But what tends seems to me to happen is that you hear about these things, but not at the time when it's really would be really relevant. All that you heard at the time you said about that it's put as though you're getting points of view, but you're not really getting. You're not actually getting the opposition to war as such. You're discussing
confined to superficial things, in fact, in some ways, about what's taking place and what was taking place there. And you didn't really hear anything until after the very large demonstration, and that was when I think Blair started talking about the moral thing about the war. But that's really is that you don't hear about it at the time. It's subsequently when on the looking back. The other thing that happens is you have these sort of news programs like say the World at One, and that they'll talk about a certain subject and have different people sort of going on at it, but you wonder how long they can keep going on just repeating, looking at the same thing or saying the same thing, and you can go away, you know, and dig the garden or something and come back and they're still saying the same thing that they were saying that we can go.
If it's on rolling news, it's probably just the same thing kind of repeated over and over every hour. So this idea that it's somehow, news as it happens, you know, no, it's wherever you're pointing a camera. Just on a slightly kind of lighter bit, actually, before I launch into something else here, but have you noticed the obsession they have in live news now with outside broadcasts? I mean, I don't know what the NUJ is doing about this. Last year, during all the winter storms, they had some poor sort of a journalist out in the snow, up in, what's it called? There's a big junction just outside of Leeds and Bradford, up on the moors, something corner it's called. And this poor guy's there, sort of standing in a sideways blizzard, going, yes, it's really cold and snowy out here, back to you in the studio. If that had been me, I'd be going, no, I'm going to do that from the studio, you know, sod your job. It's absolutely appalling. You know, I don't know why they kind of put up with this. But anyway, on a more sort of serious note, I really shouldn't kind of, you know, maybe set kind of lighter tone here, but what were you saying about the Iraq and Afghanistan wars? It's demonstrating how news is managed. All right, most of these journalists and how it is then broadcast. Most of these journalists, in fact, all of them you'll see reporting, are embedded. You know the phrase there, embedded within units, i.e., they will go around with a chaperone and will be walking around with a certain kind of military unit, and you get these kind of actually quite sort of voyeuristic, almost sort of macho kind of reports, say on Newsnight by Mark Urban, where he's down on the front line with the Marines in Helmand province, and it's like, oh look, they're shooting the towelheads and whatever, and it's you look really, oh, this is a bit wrong. And all the time you'll notice a bit wrong, very wrong, sorry, absolutely reprehensible. You know, I shouldn't mince words here, should I? But what you notice when I'm getting away from my moral outrage is that, you know, they'll usually have, you know, a trained officer with them who'll be, you know, press officers, you know, within the military, who increasingly will be accompanying them, and they'll go to them to be their talking head. So, you know, it'll be Lieutenant Farquhar, and, you know, in whatever, is the one who's rabbiting on about what they're doing in Helmand province, using the right kind of buzz and phrase words, you know. And also, of course, you know, there was a huge problem in the Iraq war for non-embedded journalists, and I mean, yet some of them were killed, all right, you know. And there's, you know, the very, very famous footage even of the CNN guy, the Arabic sort of CNN guys on Wikipedia and on the internet being machine gunned, you know, by a US helicopter gunship crew, all right, because, you know, then they've not got the right kind of transponder codes to give off to the American forces, yeah, and they're just getting hit. You know, it wasn't a matter of the Iraqis taking pops at Western journalists. You know, it's absolutely terrible. And if you watch that piece, it's just chilling. It's terrifying, the language they're using about them. You know, it's horrible. You know, and this is an implicit control device for these journalists. You know, I'm not saying they actively go out to seek to kill non-embedded journalists, but the idea is, you know, you will be with us. You will not report things that we do not want you to see. You know, that footage will be edited. You know, Al Jazeera, for example, you would see unedited, or you'd see a lot wider kind of footage of the aftermath of Western attacks on Iraq. You would see dead bodies. All right, under no circumstances were, you know, the BBC or whatever ever going to show you bits of corpses, because, you know, it was supposed to be a clean war, you know. Whereas you went on Al Jazeera, you would see what it looks like, you know, when a helicopter gunship shoots up a crowd of people. You know, there you go, right there. But why are they doing that? You know, there isn't actually a law that says, you know, you will not show it. It's because they have certain assumptions and values that they don't want to step over. And so it's not seen to do to show the actual consequences of, you know, what our so-called brave boys get up to in these places, you know, for example. So you know, that's that. I'd also recommend you get your sources from abroad. All right, usually in various countries you will get a certain different perspective, and you may find out more if you go to news outlets from another country. And obviously with the internet, and you know, like Jacqueline says, the Russia Tonight and Freeview, that's much more possible now. Russia Tonight, actually the news on it, it's pretty good, some of it. You know, you get this sort of deeper kind of analysis of the various imperialist rivalries in the Middle East. Now, you know, they're gearing up for another attack on Iran, you know, for example, which you won't necessarily get in the American media. All right, look at the press coverage of Ireland. All right, you know, back in the 80s, the 70s and the 80s, if you wanted to find out what was going on in Northern Ireland, frequently you had to read, say, the German or particularly the American media. All right, whereas if you were an American and you wanted to know what, you know, your country was up to in Central America, you know, the various awful things they were doing in places like Nicaragua and El Salvador, well, you had to go and read newspapers like The Guardian in Britain, or, you know, Le Figaro in France. Okay, so you can often get news from other countries that, you know, maybe they're not necessarily going to report, you know, in that light in that country. And interesting, actually, and just one last thing, a really interesting thing, if you ever, I think I've said this before in meetings, if you ever want a really interesting and sometimes more honest and anti-coverage of the Arab-Israeli conflict, read Haaretz, which is the Israeli equivalent of The Guardian, all right? Their left-leaning broadsheet, all right? They talk in there far more candidly about, you know, critiques of what the Israelis are doing by Israelis themselves than ever you get in the wider media, all right? Because there's almost this unwritten assumption that you don't talk about, you know, you don't criticise the Israeli army to outsiders, you know, to goyim, you know, to non-Israelis. It's just not seen to do, but you can discuss it as much as you like amongst ourselves. So you will actually get interesting kind of pieces and perspectives by people who are members of groups like Peace Now and Conscientious Objectors in Israel themselves, in things like Haaretz, that you never get in the Western press. Because, you know, you might get it in, say, Socialist Worker or something like that, but you're never going to... Well, actually, not Socialist Worker, because, you know, they don't really think Israelis are workers. But, you know what I mean? Yeah, they have an awful perspective on it, but that's going way off the point. You know, but you might get it in certain sort of small presses, is what I'm saying. You've really got to dig around. You know, I'm not saying that the news isn't out there. You've got to dig around for it, and, it takes work. And, of course, you know, as we know, not all of us have got the time to or the inclination to be doing that. You know, again, it's something I've seen Noam Chomsky say on this. He says, you know, if you do a 10-hour day and you commute 2 hours a day, you're not always going to have the time or the energy to be doing a huge academic research project into what's going on. You know, you just want to slump and sit down and watch a light sitcom and, you know, go to bed. You know, you don't have the time to do it. So you have to be very, very aware of how you consume news as a product. You know, it's not just this neutral kind of process. Okay.
Jacqueline?
Two things. The main thing I want to say before I forget it is there any challenge towards the mass media at the moment, or the capitalist media? Is there a challenge out there in your view? The other thing is, there's always the individual. I know we deal with class, but there's always the individual within that class who will come forward, like John Pilger's, and the, I can never remember this man's name, he's a German who put a camera in his bag and watched Germans inducing Turkish immigrants in Germany, knowing they would get cancer and sending them back to Turkey. I watched that programme in Germany at the time, and I was shocked at that, but if it hadn't been for the journalist who did it, the investigative journalist, and I rate John Pilger, before all these in their khaki suits and their helmets and everything, these little modern nonsense that they go on with, he was out there in the front line informing us, the general public, what was going on. I'm not saying there was no slant, but the main part is there anything challenging the capitalist media, apart from ourselves, of course?
I'd say there is, Jacqueline. You know, there's a lively kind of underground, there always has been, of, you know, various newspapers, websites and so forth, you know, indie media, things like that, just getting a different perspective on these things, you know, people putting out their own sort of points of view. And like I said, you know, this is how we'll do it. You know, it's a part of our activity, after all. And, you know, we're quite explicit, actually, in the Socialist Party of Great Britain. We call some of what we do propaganda. And we're using it in an old-fashioned sort of sense of the word. But, you know, it's almost like kind of counter-propagandising. You know, this idea that you can always be cool and neutral. You know, I mean, when you're sort of putting forward these ideas, I certainly can't, you know. you might have got them slightly kind of upset and outraged at certain things, you know, within the sort of course of this afternoon, you know. But I think it's very much a DIY thing. It's up to us, and that's good because we can control it kind of democratically, and that's much better than having things, you know, beamed at us in a kind of passive way. And as I say, you know, a commodity. What I will say, I mean, the reason why I'm particularly into these ideas as well, and I've kind of broached around it, is you get an awful lot of nonsense spoken, however, you know, there's an awful lot of kind of conspiracy theories about the media out there, you know. So what you need to do is have a kind of rational approach that you can verify, you know, and give kind of concrete examples of, rather than just saying, oh, well, you know, it's the Bilderberg group, you know, or yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, as we know, you know, you get a lot of implicit and sometimes explicit anti-Semitism, actually, from people when they're talking about the media. You know, it's the rich liberal Jewish elite, particularly in the States. You know, I mean, you know, you just look at some of the... And this is actually quite increasingly kind of mainstream in things like the you know, a lot of the Republican Party and the Tea Party. And it's always been a kind of strand within that kind of... particularly American kind of populist right-wing sort of strand of thinking, which is kind of, you know, now going global with sort of globalisation and whatever, that you blame shadowy little cliques and elites, sometimes not, you know, specifically Jewish people, for running the media and having some kind of sinister agenda that they're kind of forcing upon you in a very kind of crude kind of caricature of the idea. So, you know, so there's that. I mean, actually, a great thing... the people on the political right in this country really bang on about in a really, I mean, I think completely irrational way, is, you know, the supposed kind of, you know, socialist, and not in our sense, but left-wing bias of the BBC. You know, the BBC is stuffed full of communists. You know, I was watching the BBC the other day going, I can't really see this. You know, it's, yeah, because, you know, they're not actually, you know, putting across their own kind of managed point of view. You know, either presumably they would see a kind of fair neutral network as somebody like Fox, you know, or Sky, actually. You know, and Sky will occasionally put a lot more kind of anti- people on, like George Galloway, but it's increasingly because they're put on to be pilloried rather than actually, you know, any real kind of discussion. You know, I just watch kind of Fox News from the States. I mean, it's rabid. You know, don't they?
Yeah, I think that there is a website, Media Lens.
Media Lens, that's it. Yes,
definitely. Is, yeah. They criticise the mainstream media in this country, the BBC, the Guardian, particularly Independent, occasionally the Times, and they've taken them to task. They've sent emails. If you go there, they send email after email after email to get these people to analyse what they're saying. And in fact, you didn't mention, one person, Andrew Marr, for instance, who Andrew Marr has at least admitted that he was over-enthusiastic about Blair and Britain going into Iraq. I mean, they've done a hell of a lot of good. Now, the BBC, I mean, I started listening to the BBC when I was in first job, which was in Nigeria, so I used to listen to the World Service. And there, the BBC for us was Britain, that's the first B, second one was business, and the third one was Christianity. And I'm afraid it's not that much difference now. We're less nationalistic, probably, with the domestic service, but the BBC is hopelessly business-orientated. We've got Evan Davis, for instance, on the Today program, because the morning one was that's today, okay? And he is, he has the bottom line. And I don't watch television, so I don't know what the Dragon's Den is exactly about. But he never questions anybody at all. He's a yes man, all right. Another one is Peter Day, the Benighted Day, who always promotes, you know, gets businessmen to explain what they want, etc., etc. It's hopelessly businessly orientated, and during this recent financial crisis, they've not really had anybody who's questioning the system at all. It's all business people who cause the problem in the first place, and how do they get out of it? Or what opportunities are there for making money out of it? Or how should people protect themselves against it? They never, ever question the system.
And as for the religious programmes, Thought for the Day, etc., that is just propaganda as well. Really speaking, it's promoting untruth. It's promoting the idea that people should believe things without any evidence. And of course, that suits the political elites in this country fine. Okay, lots of things I could say there. As regards questions, I mean, you mentioned, I think, any questions. I, as I say, I don't watch television, but any question. Sorry.
Any questions or question time?
Yeah, that's right. It's the other one. Question time, I don't know.
Question time, yeah.
But I've looked at any questions, for instance, and that's rigged.
That's the same
thing. They have four people.
Rigged.
They have four people. They have a Conservative, a Liberal Democrat, and a Labour Party person, and some other celebrity, possibly a local person, or somebody who's written a book or something like that. And that is the range in which they discuss things. They don't go outside that range and question the whole system. Hardly ever. It's completely and utterly rigged. The parties in this country at the minute are very, very close to each other. So we do not get a wide range of opinion. That really is rigged. And the question, you know, the BBC pat themselves on the head for their balance. Okay? Mm. Of course, balance depends where you stick the balancing point. Mm. You could stick it anywhere. And the balancing point is very, very much to the right, as far as I'm concerned, or certainly centre and right. We don't get a situation where you get questioning of what Britain is doing in the world. Another thing, you know, they want to have two experts on who to balance things up. But I mean, with things like climate change, for instance, where most scientists just accept the fact that there is climate change, well over 90%. What do? They have one climate change expert against Nigel Lawson. You know, and that's balance. Mm. I mean, Nigel Lawson, as far as I'm concerned, on these matters, is a nutter.
Yeah.
Completely nutter, but that's BBC balance. And I think that the BBC is... I don't read a newspaper, I don't watch television. I try and get my news other ways. But I do listen to the BBC Radio 4 and the World Service to pick up the propaganda. And I miss the propaganda completely. If I go to Media Lens, often they've analysed what's wrong and they've actually done something about it. It doesn't come out into the public. People will slang off Media Lens for being left-wing loonies, etc., but not, they're actually doing a reasonable job at getting some of these BBC people, like Helen Bowden, who's head of the news thing, to actually look at what they've said and look at their policy and trying to get them to admit that they're totally and utterly biased.
I'd also, I mean, I'd never pass up an opportunity to plug Media Lens because I think it's such an excellent site. Apart from the analysis, they sometimes invite guests. Guests to come and write an article on their site, and particularly journalists. And over the years, they've had a number of journalists who've come on and written very, very interesting articles of this very subtle process of filters of how they have simply been filtered out of the system. There's one guy I particularly remember who said for years and years and years, he'd sort of picked up this kind of vague left-wing criticism as he'd seen it in the media and says, well, nobody tells me what to think. Until it came to a time when he took a view which was very much against what was his editorial view, suddenly he found himself completely without a job. Yeah, so he had to completely revise his view. So there is all sorts of very interesting stuff going on this site. There is also an American site called Fair, which I'm sure you know, which does a similar Fair,
Fair and Accuracy in Reporting.
In reporting, which does a similar job, but I don't actually think it does it quite so well as Media Lens. I do think Media Lens, of course, does not take our point of view. It does actually tend to take a more left-wing point of view, so it will veer sometimes to playing off one sort of national capitalist against non-national capitalist. But having said that, it's the meat of what it's saying is really very, very useful stuff.
And can I just add this? There's another group, the Glasgow University Media Group, who are superb. Greg Fillo and those people. They're doing a lot of, you know, they're using this thing, you know, I've been talking about the propaganda model to demonstrate how news is, you know, filtered and whatever. They did a superb book I think 2004, 2005, called Bad News from Israel. Which is an absolutely superb study.
It's actually divided into three parts, and the third part is to actually interview people who've listened to the BBC, and they came to the conclusion that the more people listen to the BBC, the less they understood about Israel.
But apparently there was some, they interviewed some 20-year-olds, and the 20-year-olds all said that they were, through listening to the BBC, had come to the conclusion that it was actually the Palestinians who were occupying the occupied territory.
Right, that's right, yes. Right. The Palestinians were the baddies who had were occupying Israeli land.
Or another thing, of course, you know, is the idea that this is a centuries-old conflict. You know, I mean, it's absolute bullshit. You know, frankly, I mean, for hundreds of years, it was safer to be Jewish in a Muslim society than it was in a Christian society, okay? You know, pogroms didn't happen in a Muslim society, all right? You know, the Holocaust happened in a, you know, basically insane pagan European society, okay? You know, it didn't happen in Muslim societies. You know, when there were expulsions from, say, Spain and Portugal in the Middle Ages and from a lot of other European parts of the country, a lot of Jewish people went to the Ottoman Empire, you know, settled around places like Salonika and Lebanon and you know, and whatnot, but you know, throughout the Ottoman Empire, because it was safer, because there wasn't this assumption within Islam that Jews are a, you know, alien minority. You know, as long as you kind of, you know, paid the tax to the Sultan, you know, you were more or less like left alone. And, you know, in fact, at various times, various sultans would take great pains to punish people who were attacking Jewish communities and people, you know, or kind of Christian communities as well, for that point of view. I'm not, you know, I don't want to portray the Ottoman Empire as a wonderful kind of, you know, multicultural, tolerant kind of society,
it benefited from the Jews.
It certainly did.
And Cromwell invited Jews into this country in order for them to bring in their skills, banking
exactly.
skills particularly.
Exactly. Yeah.
There was quite an interesting radio. I think it was Radio 3 program on a couple of weeks ago. The chap who grew up in Baghdad, and apparently until we put in our own, well, our own, until the West put in its own puppet regime in Baghdad, there was a huge and thriving Jewish community there. Apparently one third of the population of Baghdad was actually Jewish at one time and perfectly integrated into the culture. And then as soon as kind of we had people like Saddam Hussein put in, it all started to break down.
And also, of course, you know, the Israeli state early on had a policy of trying to attract Jewish communities from Egypt, you know, and Iraq. So you actually have quite a percentage of the Israeli population who, you know, are... the old phrase was Sephardim, and that's, you know, that's actually not a PC term anymore in Israel. So if I'm upsetting anybody, I genuinely apologise, you know, as opposed to Ashkenazi, you know, European descended Jews who often and still are in, you know, all the positions of responsibility and power within Israel, largely speaking. You know, that's very, very true. You know, huge Jewish communities throughout the Middle East, all the way in Morocco. You know, Libya, Tripoli, and of course, you know, Egypt. You know, very, very various people were you know, descended from these that, you know, that you might have heard of. You know, he subsequently ended up, you know, not going to Israel, going to the West. You know, actually, I'm thinking about the family of you know, Gene Simmons from the rock band Kiss. I mean, you know, his family are Hungarian and Egyptian Jews originally. You know, for example, you know, his real name isn't Gene Simmons. I can't remember what it is. But anyway, you know, there you go. But you know, that's his background. Actually, one of the guys who's in the New York Dolls as well, another punk band at the time. He's from an Egyptian Jewish family via New York. So yeah, there you go. But anyway, how do we get onto that?
Okay, I'll take. I think we're starting to get on now. So I'll take a couple more questions, and then I think we'll start to wind up.
Mine isn't a question. I'd just like to get that name of the last
The Glasgow University Media Group.
Thank
you
very much.
Greg Philo.
I can give you Greg Philo. PHILO. I can give you, if you want, a copy of Bad News from Israel.
Lovely.
Because I've got the new one, and then the old one. Right. I don't need any more.
Right. So if anybody wants it, University
Media Group.
And also the Strathclyde one as well.
That's one I'm not familiar with.
Yeah, which is Spinwatch.
Oh, okay.
Lovely, thank you.
Thanks,
Anyone else? Any more questions? Anyone been holding on to a question and wants to really go? Because I'm going to bring the axe down if you know my
name. Yeah,
Graham,
I'd love that.
Yeah, have it, by all means.
Very good.
Okay, yeah. I'd like to thank everyone then for a collection of £17.32. Thanks very much indeed. As I said, we've got another meeting here in a fortnight's time, 2:30, not 4 o'clock. May I repeat, just to get it burned into your...
I'll tell the speaker then.
Thank you. Okay, and thank you very much indeed. There's tea and coffee and biscuits and cakes upstairs. Rob, thank you. Sorry, and finally, Rob, thank you very much.
Absolutely.